I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today, I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Steve McLaughlin, who at arsonism.org has fed us a steady stream of inventive sound works, including Levy Leto palindrome, angle penny, and Alaskan propositions, as well as conceptual and other text experiments, including at least one notorious slash controversial giant appropriation, and who is the media editor of the New Jacket magazine, and who from the beginning of Poem Talk has been our constant and brilliant audio editor. And by Kenneth Goldsmith, whose writing has been called by Publishers Weekly some of the most exhaustive and beautiful collage work yet produced in poetry. Author of 9 books, founding editor of the amazing online archive Ubuweb, editor of I'll Be Your Mirror, selected Andy Warhol interviews, and teacher here at Penn, I'm happy to say, of courses on uncreative writing and writing through contemporary art. And by Nada Gordon, author of many books, longtime proud member of the Flarf Collective, an incipient filmmaker. Is incipient a word you would still use for that?
Yeah.
Okay. An incipient filmmaker who practices poetry as deep entertainment, whose absolutely always striking blog entries can be found at ululate.blogspot.com, and whose Penn Sound page includes poems I repeatedly listen to for fun. Sheep Nose, Lick My Face, I Love Men, and Abnormal Discharge, among others. Hello, all three of you. Welcome to the Writer's House, Nada. And to Poem Talk for the second time, hi.
Hi. Yeah.
Kenny, always lovely to see your happy face.
Except you never mentioned my version of Nada's I Love Men, which is on my Penn Sound page.
It's tons of fun. However, I was introducing Nada at that moment. And Steve, nice to have you finally with us on this side of the microphone.
Oh, thanks. Pleasure to be here.
So our poem today is one that Sharon Mesmert performed at a Flarf Poetry Festival we hosted at the Writer's House in 2007, our first explicitly Flarfist gathering, which was in fact organized by our own Steve McLaughlin. Mesmer was hilariously good as always at that event and read for us some Flarfy gems such as Jake Gyllenhaal's Dog and Atomic Bitch Wax, which is Charles Bernstein's favorite poem by Mesmer, and also the poem we'll discuss today, which is titled I Accidentally Ate Some Chicken and Now I'm in Love with Harry Whittington. So here now is Sharon Mesmer reading that poem from our Mesmer Penn Sound author page.
And my first poem is about a forgotten celebrity, Harry Whittington. He's the guy that Cheney shot. So this is, I accidentally ate some chicken and now I'm in love with Harry Whittington. Have you ever been in a situation where somebody you thought was your friend did something that hurt you very much and then they tried to blame it on you and then you had a heart attack? Just wondering. I thought Jack Abramoff was my buddy, a small fish with a large chicken. What a dick. Why'd he have to remind me of my first wife, Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy Onassis Bono Crow Pitt DeGeneres Federline? Of course, that speaks volumes to and of itself. On the other hand, everything tastes like chicken, and cooked people taste like butter. I barely touched the clam chowder, but I ate the chicken fried steak. Then I ate the sludgy chicory and accidentally drove the hot and sporty. Now I may try the chicken fries. Who pooed Vindaloo? The founding fathers risked life and limb just so I could trust the Kung Pao ham. But the former potions master spiked my poly juice with mango juice, and now I like drinks with chicks in them. Does anyone care about my feelings? All I wanted to do was kill little birds, because, you know, that's fun. I forget which one am I banging, that plain bitch or the ambassador to Switzerland. I'd ask Dick but which of the two he's screwing, but he never answers my emails. In other news, I've been up to my neck in new food intern activity. The skewers are kind of like hot wings, except they're made with chicken tenders. The backwash is kind of long, but watch the whole thing for the slow-mo Matrix-esque finale. Way cooler than any other stick figure theater. A barn-raised quail just said, "Bugs Bunny isn't real." Is there no end to the horrors this shooting will reveal?
Nada, I'm not hoping that we spend the entire time talking about this as an example of FLARF, but I think we should start there. What's FLARFy about it, would you say? Is it a good example?
You know, one thing that always seems really weird to me is when FLARF poems are kind of abstracted from the FLARF list context, because, you know, they always sort of take place in this world where memes and words are getting batted back and forth, and people are responding.
By FLARF list, you mean the listserv.
Right. And so, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't say this is typical or necessarily like a good example of a FLARF poem. It took place in this sort of larger constellation of stuff.
Well, just for the sake of introducing the topic, what are the FLARFy qualities?
Probably the pop culture references, which several of which I didn't, like, I couldn't remember who Jack Abramoff was. I had to Google him this morning.
Did you really? Boy, yeah. Short memories we have.
Yeah, it's true. Certainly, like, the speech elements, you know, because you know that's fun, that kind of thing. That's very much
it. Who pooed Vindaloo. You've got a source for that?
I don't know about the source, but I think it's an echo of Who Slew Auntie Rue.
Yes. Yeah. Good. Not bad. Okay. So it's FLARFy
in terms
the
of
sense
this being,
that...
In terms of this being, you know, good or skillfully done, I'm really kind of in love with the rhymed couplet at the end. I mean, that's a sort of rare occurrence for a FLARF poem, I would say.
Yeah, to me it's the only trace of, quote, poetry in the poem. And actually, I disagree with you. I actually find that to be a real letdown at the end, and because it does assume a poetic trope, and I thought it was so beautiful that it was anti-poetic, and then suddenly we have that last thing. But then in your world, everything's always sort of upside down anyway, so what's bad is good and what's good is bad. And so maybe the kitschy ending, that ended couplet, is in fact something that's so bad that it might be good in terms of FLARF.
I don't see FLARF as being anti-poetic. But,
neither do I. I mean, always the contrarian, Kenny. You're really so harsh and unforgiving. Yeah. I mean, Sharon Mesmer, in addition to being a good FLARF poet, is actually a very good poet. And of course, these elements were in her work long before the FLARF list was founded. And if you read things she's written in 1998, 2000, and so on and so forth, there is this this idea of shifting from one voice to the other, just on and on and on, and you know, for her sense of humor and the pop culture references, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of this
That the sound play is really, it seems to me, carefully wrought. I don't mean necessarily to celebrate it, but I'll just point it out. I mean, the short I sound of chicken is all through the poem. Chicken and witting, as in Whittington, is essentially a near rhyme that gets repeated. And then there's chicken and Dick, as in Dick Cheney. So indeed. She's so, really playing. She's doing a lot of sound.
Indeed. And so to flip your question, Al, I would say that, you know, there's something very characteristic of the FLARF movement in this poem, certainly, but there's something very Sharon Mesmer-y about the FLARF movement itself. I mean, it goes in the opposite direction.
You seem to have misunderstood me. The lack of its poetic qualities to me was a good thing. I mean, I like it because it doesn't have poetic qualities. And then
I have the exact opposite take on it. I think that FLARF is not anti-poetic. I think it's super poetic. That is just expanding the net of what of what a poem can be.
Yeah, it's interesting. It actually then begins to really, I think, bring up the differences between our two approaches, and you know, which I'm.
Yeah, we have some serious doctrinal stuff to work out.
Yeah,
you
we
and
do.
I, Kenny.
We
right
do.
Here and now.
And yet I'm a great admirer. But I'm a great admirer of the less formal or the less poetic aspects. So, for example, conceptual writing never versifies or lineates anything. It's really opposed to poetic form in that way. it just doesn't do it, because it doesn't, I can't understand the why this is lineated to me. There's nothing in the lineation except for those last couplet that actually seems to really demand that. So why is it lineated? For formal form, you know, for form's sake? It, you know, it could flow, and I do love this piece very much. But what I don't like about it is its need to look like a poem. I think that makes it a little more conventional for me.
I think there is a conventionality to this poem and to Sharon's poetry in general that I'm not necessarily disparaging. But, it, you know, what's interesting is that not long after this, I brought up a question on the Flarf List, and I actually brought it with me. This was back in 2006, where I asked, you know, let me find it. How come flarfists tend to smooth out the grammar in flarf works so much? It seems like there's a move to make them somehow reader-friendly and less raw. I do this too, but as always, I'm drawn to mistakes, misspellings, word lists, etc. And then another question I bring up is it because the content is so jangled and fucked up that we tend to make the syntactical forms more regular to compensate?
Yeah, interesting.
But I think in general, Sharon's work tends to flow and be extremely, I mean, not discursive, but discursive in its forms.
And the content is not jangled and fucked up. The content is, you know, we all hate Harry Whittington for allowing himself to be shot and not even complaining because he's in the same party as the guy who shot him. This could be straightened out slightly. This could be just any kind of liberal left rant against that mode. Right? I mean, to broadly, I mean, I can't believe I'm talking about content here, but to broadly say that this thing about how everything tastes like chicken is the sort of flat cultural crappy analog to my feelings about this Texas Republican quail shooting outing is remarkable and funny and wonderful, not unusual, not something that you would never hear at table talk. Presented in this poetic way, though, Kenny, I'm, you know, it makes me think just slightly of the earnest lyrical voice of confessional first-person poetry that's completely degenerated because it was poetic and it was lineated. And I want to go to Steve, who seems to have something to say.
Well, this is actually, I mean, I find that quite interesting, and I came to a similar conclusion during the meaning-making process. But I think you were flattening it out a little bit too much here.
Well, I was talking about content, and we're talking about Sharon Mesmer.
No, but even in content, just, I agree that you're flattening it out
a
little bit.
Well, yeah, part of it is...
Well, that's my job as a host.
There's also a lot of... I mean, in Annoying Diabetic Bitch, there's a lot of anti-Bush rhetoric, little snippets, pieces of phrases and names and so forth. Part of it, I think, is that she's... I mean, I'm sure that she's on the left side politically. Or I'm not sure. I don't know her personally. But I suspect she's on the left personally. However, yeah. I have a feeling that she's also mocking some of these people who are mocking Bush. I mean, these are all somewhat disembodied. And to get to that, your attempt to encapsulate this into a political message, have you guys looked up the origin of the backbone of this poem?
You mean Harry Whittington shooting?
Did we reverse engineer it?
No, specifically the actual text. It begins... Have you ever been in a situation where somebody you thought was your friend, et cetera, et cetera?
Yes.
This is taken from a post, which is at harrywhittington.blogspot.com, which is not Harry Whittington. It's an imposter. He made multiple posts. And the original post was, have you ever been in a situation where somebody you thought was your friend did something that hurt you very much, and then they tried to blame it on you? And then that person waited 18 hours to report it to the media, and that person's colleagues tried to make a joke out of it until you had a heart attack? Just wondering.
Wow.
This is straight from this
you
is straight
your
from
homework.
And the majority of the rest of this poem.
Of course, his homework consisted of Googling it, probably.
But that was also how the poem was written.
This is the close reading mode in Flarf,
So readers do what
the close
writers
reading,
do.
Close reading mode in Flarf is reverse Googling. That's very good.
And I have to say, the majority of this...
Kenny just approved of what you did.
Thanks, Kenny. and the majority of the rest of the poem is taken from comments on this fake post. So apparently the fake post got some attention from Daily Coast. Many other people read it. Some people were mad. Some people were silly. Anyway, on and on.
But what it says to me is that normative language, ordinary language, is full of poetic qualities. And we don't really need to embellish it even more to lineate it. I mean, we need to recontextualize it into the space of poetry in order for it to be art. That's the difference between the blog spot. But when I look at it on the sheet that Steve printed out from the blog, and I look at it here, I see absolutely no reason for this to be lineated.
Nada, when you lineate your own flarfy stuff, what are you thinking about? Are you trying to participate in the tradition in order to overturn it?
I'm thinking of enjambment. Yeah. I mean, seriously, I try to lineate for a reason, and also, you know, to create eye rhythms. And I think Sharon does too. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I could really find that in this poem so much, but she actually teaches a course on prosody at the New School, I think. And she was talking about how shocking it was that her, I shouldn't say this.
Delete it.
Why don't you say it? And then okay. If we decide right. It can't be on well, poem then, talk, then no one will
of,
hear
some
it.
Of her students actually didn't know what enjambment was. And like, how shocking is that, that, you know, MFA students in poetry wouldn't know what enjambment was?
Maybe
you know
because
we're,
it's...
We're leaving that in.
You are.
Of course we are, because I think that's totally relevant and important.
So,
and it's almost in itself a rejoinder to Kenny's concern, but I'm not sure
so
how.
She said, yeah, you know what it means? It means that I shove my fist up your ass.
I am not surprised, by the way. I'll just throw this in. I know, Kenny, you want to say something.
Yes.
I'm not surprised that Sharon Mesmer teaches prosody. Uh-huh. There's all kinds of prosody in here, which makes me think, Kenny, that, you know, the lineation is a way, is a wink and saying, you know, it's anti-poetic and poetic, and I want to be in that tradition. I don't want, this is not a conceptual project.
Well, it actually is a conceptual project, because when you're simply taking pre-existing text and reframing it into a new format, it's completely conceptual. Yeah, obviously, Steve's investigation shows us that it is the exact same thing, almost to the word.
Not real, but it's very, very doctored, very relineated, not a straight copy of that. There are pieces of terms from other things mixed in. Often a sentence will be quoted with one or two words changed. I mean, this is all. This
it's
is
it's say it's a poem.
It's right. Smoothed out. It's smoothed out a little bit. But I think not.
Did Jackson
McClough
lineate the computer generated stuff? Yes. You have a problem with that too?
Well, that's a big topic.
No, I'm sorry.
Hold on. Did Jackson lineate his own computer?
He did lineate the stuff, most of it.
Yeah, most of Jackson's stuff looked like poetry, but most of language poetry looked like poetry, too.
But Jackson's not writing language poetry. He's closer to the conceptual project that you're talking about that you don't want to be lineated.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is really a kind of a conceptual bent on things that we always can't understand why people lineate. And the fact that the students didn't know what enjambment was, I think, is a very good thing. Why would anybody care?
Why would anybody these days need to know about enjambment? Why were you upset?
Yes.
Not a Gordon. You were upset about revealing this.
I'm but. In this to... I was upset because I don't want to somehow feel that I've violated Sharon's trust or her teacher-student relationships. I mean, it's very much an interpersonal thing. But I'm also upset because, I mean, I'm extremely attached to notions of poeticity. And that includes, like, title, lines, and aura. I'm totally not willing to give that up. I don't think it's gone. And I think that Flarf borrows aura by putting the words into verse.
So form. Flarf is corrosive often. What's it corroding if it's not corroding poetic convention? Notions of high culture as opposed to low? What's corrosive
is
about it?
Is it corroding or is it somehow
every definition
equalizing?
Every definition I've ever
That's true. Gary
read.
Actually is
Gary
corrosive.
Sullivan says corrosive, cute, and cloying. Awfulness, I think, is the phrase he uses.
Yeah,
and,
that's become a real
okay, so maybe it's not
cliche.
Corrosive anymore, but let's just try it. What is it corroding? What's corrosive about it, if it is?
Well, I think we need to unpack that.
Well,
is it actually corrosive? I don't know.
Right, I think to rephrase that in perhaps more straightforward terms, let's see, the obvious divisive question regarding an apparently political poem of this sort is it in fact a legitimate or a worthwhile, productive critique, or is it some kind of nihilistic revelry? To that effect, I have a great quote.
So
from,
I think the former, and I
I'm
think
not,
you think
I'm
it's
not,
the latter.
I'm not entirely
right?
making a claim for the latter. I think I have a quote from Sharon, which would potentially illuminate this a bit. This is from the postscript of Knowing Diabetic Bitch, the book from which this poem was read. She says, there's a scene in Werner Herzog's 1979 remake of Nosferatu where the citizens of a town gripped by plague dance and sing and carouse among corpses rotting and burning in the town square. In a way, Fluff does pretty much the same thing, but without that awful stench. And so there's definitely a dual nature there.
Kenny, what are you thinking?
What I love about Flarf is exactly what Nada's saying. It's doing things that poetry has just never done before. And I think this is its great claim. It's bringing techniques that have never been used in poetry. It's trawling, it's bottom feeding in a way that the New York School played with. They wanted to be bad, but they never could be bad. The kind of embrace of the low that happens here, I think, is absolutely remarkable. And this is what I really love about Flarfin. This is doing something incredibly new. This has never been done in poetry. I mean, you know, schoolboy limericks. But the fact here, and one of my favorite lines in this is really incredible, is just the Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy Onassis Bono Crow Pitt DeGeneres Fetter line. And that's the one that gets me, is the inclusion of Federline. And I think that is just, there's just no boundaries. And I think this is really the most brilliant thing about what Flarf is doing.
Sometimes, Kenny, you've said to me, one conceptual project or another falls flat because the choice of materials was wrong or because it just wasn't remarkable. And I don't even want to go to what remarkable would mean in that context. I feel this, and I agree with you, and I feel the same way about Flarf. This is a poem that succeeds because the serendipity of choices of material, the Whittington story, I just think it's great. But it's also the case that outside the Flarf list, where you're just throwing things out and giving, seeing what sticks on the wall, or you're not even worried about what sticks on the wall, let it fall to the floor, but put out there in a book, in print, some stuff really just, that works for Flarf, and some stuff doesn't. Do you think the same applies? Project ideas are just not going to work? And if so, what happened to the real bottom feeding?
Well, I mean, it's McLowian or Cagean again. It's constructing a machine is one part of it, but knowing what to feed into that machine is the other part of it.
And feeding this works, this Whittington stuff, but feeding something else might not work.
Sharon is, I'm going to use the T word, taste. I mean, she's got terrific taste. She's got,
I was trying to get you to say.
Absolutely. So, absolutely.
It tastes like chicken.
No, but she tastes like chicken means everything tastes the same.
Yeah, but I mean,
so that's a problem.
Another criticism of the Flarf movement. Every poem tastes the same is what you find many dismissive bloggers saying.
Is this a meta poem about Flarfism?
I don't think it is. I always thought it was.
You did think it was.
Yeah.
Do you feel that
wait, Kenny, we have a nice thing going here. It's not a meta poem.
No.
It's not about the movement.
Well, I mean, any poem might be fractally that.
Yeah,
But I don't think it's, particularly that. But I want to propose a third reading that's different from the two. Can you remind me of what they were? Nihilistic revelry and then the critique.
Productive critique,
nihilistic revelry. I think this is a poem about compassion.
Huh.
Sorry to freak you out with that.
I'm freaked out now. I don't know where we're going.
I think everything's fair game. Bring everything you know. I'm not a new critic. Bring everything you know about the poet, the person, the movement. Sharon Mesmer is a vegetarian.
Who pooed Vindaloo.
Not only that, her father was a butcher. So I think that we need to really, read this poem in that light.
Sounds like childhood trauma.
She has strong sort of Buddhistic leanings as well. Yeah. And, if you read this poem, not just as, what you know about Flarf as a movement, but, what you know about what we know about Sharon Mesmer, I think that it sort of casts a whole other light.
So you mocked my straightforward political reading, but now I'm back to Whittington because the idea that Sharon could take this trauma about meat and think about Republican Texan politics in this way is remarkably interesting to me as a politics. Is anybody going to mock that now?
Well, I just want to make a comment on what Nada said. I mean, it is impossible to suppress one's personality when choosing works. And obviously, she may be Googling, but she's Googling with an intention. And she's Googling as a result I've never heard the backstory, but it makes perfect sense to me, which makes the work even more convincing. It's real convincing to start with because she does have such great taste. But it's also more convincing because you can't suppress personality and ego in work. And this is why I feel writers are always trying too hard to express themselves when in fact every gesture of a writer is expressive of themselves. And I do believe in expression, absolutely, in that way.
And I should note that it's not as though she is completely apolitical or only questionably political. Much of her work is explicitly political. A poem like Working Class Typeface comes to mind. Or
yes, I was just thinking about that poem.
Great, much more explicit regarding.
And my issues. Line breaks kick your line breaks ass.
Yeah, right, yeah, their line breaks kick.
Yeah, right. Yeah, do you have that at your fingertips? Because I think that's actually. I think I put a dog so ear Steven, on it.
Yeah. While Steve's looking for it, I will say that we could. We could talk about this stuff for a long time, so I want to ask each of you to just throw in one final comment or idea that you want to make sure is part of this conversation, and Nada, I will invite you not only to make a final comment, but maybe read a few lines from that poem we were just talking about. So, okay. Steve, do you want to start a final word?
Okay. This doesn't relate to the conversation so far, but as generally silly as I find the institution of the Poet Laureate, unfortunately, Sharon Mesmer recently lost out for the position of Poet Laureate of Brooklyn, and I'm pulling for her next time. Okay. Next time around.
We were actually making fun of the new Poet Laureate of Brooklyn on today's Flarflist, I should
yeah,
say.
Yeah, she's well.
I want to say that I think that one of the problems with Flarf has been its coterie orientation, that, hey, I'm not on the Flarflist. I may be missing a lot. And I think that's a really easy hit to give Flarf. And what happens, though, when removed from that in a poem like what we're reading, is that that vanishes. It vanishes completely. The poem stands on its own in a very, very strong way, not needing to lean on from whence it came, from the context, from the list, from the coterie. So I actually think that this is a bit of a false criticism toward Flarf.
Thanks, Kenny. Nada.
So this is Blue Collar Typeface. She comes from a blue-collar background, and I'll just read the last few lines. But that doesn't mean that blue-collar people are utilitarian or perfectly simple. I know lots of useless, imperfectly complicated blue-collar people, and their line breaks kick your line breaks' ass. And so I guess what I love about this poem and Sharon's writing in general, and by this poem I mean the Harry Whittington piece, is sort of combination of ingenuousness, like especially in that last, it's like a smart-ass ingenuousness, and like full-on testicularity. I just think she, never holds back.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Thank you, Nada. We like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good, to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. So who wants to announce or recommend something? Steve, you want to start?
I'd like to give a plug to the poetry magazine Midrib, which is published at midribpoetry.com. It's edited by Gordon Fehler and Andrew Mautrich, and publishing some really interesting stuff from the current scene in New York, such as it is.
Thank you. Nada.
I would like to praise three little chapbooks that Brandon Brown, a San Francisco poet, has recently published. One is called The Orgy, another is called Tooth Fairy, and most recently his most Flarf-inflected work. He's a recent member of the Flarf Collective, Your Mom's a Falconress.
Thank you. Well, that's all the ubiquitous chicken taste we have time for in Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration with the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Nada Gordon, Kenny Goldsmith, and Steve McLaughlin, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer, James Lamar, and to our editor, the self-same Steve McLaughlin. Next time on Poem Talk, Bob Perlman, Charles Bernstein, and Rachel Blau-Duplessis join me to talk about one of Charles Olson's Maximus poems. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again for that or another Poem Talk.